Welcome. I can tell this is not your first poetry reading because it's starting late and you seem okay with that. So it seems like you've got this thing down. So welcome to our first shelter belt reading of the spring semester. Thank you so much for finding us in this new location. Really appreciate you coming out tonight. A couple of things I want to mention before I introduce Richie. First of all, if you have a cell phone, maybe silence it if you haven't yet. I heard a bell. Someone else is coming. So be sure to turn off your cell phone. I want to thank a few of our sponsors for this series tonight. First of all, Department of English. Thank you so much. The College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the Vachel Lindsay Association, and WUIS. We really appreciate the space and all the work you've done this week getting the word out. So come on. Thank you so much. Christina, the bookstore. Thank you. Thank you for being here to sell books. Richie's book is for sale there in the back as well. So if you're interested in purchasing a copy, they're back there. It's my honor to welcome Richie Hoffman tonight to UIS to read from his first collection of poems, Second Empire, which is winner of the 2014 Beatrice Hawley Award from Alice James Books. He's a recipient of a 2012 Ruth Lilly Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation. His poems have appeared in many wonderful places, including The New Yorker, The Kenyon Review, The New Republic, Plowshares, New England Review, The New Criterion, Yale Review, and Poetry. All the good places. He's received fellowships from numerous places, including Breadloaf, The Kenyon Review, Writers Workshop, Swanee, and others. He's a doctoral student at Emory University and also teaches in the Kenyon Review Young Writers Workshop, where I had the chance to meet Richie and hang out with him. It's kind of like poetry camp, basically, so it's good. With Kara Van de Graaff, he edits Lightbox, an online educational resource featuring original interviews with poets and materials for classroom use. Since its publication in November last year, Second Empire has received glowing reviews from a number of critics, including Publishers Weekly, which calls the book a debut collection that feels like a lost manuscript of early modernism, which is pretty high praise, I think. The reviewer connects Richie's poems to the work of Hart Crane, a poet that balances the mind's wild wanderings with the constraint and lyricism of structure and music. It goes without saying that for a poet, one of the most difficult jobs, and I guess for all writers too, is decide what to include in a poem or a story and what to leave out. Last weekend, I had the chance to hear Wendy C. Ortiz talk about this a little bit, this idea of omission, and she referenced this famous quote from Hemingway about writing being like an iceberg, right? So when you see an iceberg, you only see an eighth of it, and what really makes the iceberg move is what's underneath the surface. And Hemingway said it. I'm sure someone said it before him, probably. But it's a good metaphor for writing, but I don't think it applies to all writers. And I thought about this a lot reading Richie's work this week. I say this because what I see in Richie's work is not the tip of the iceberg moving because of what's underneath, but what I see is a sculpture meticulously created from something much larger than itself. What the poet omits from sight is no longer important. What's left behind is what we need to see the world. And these poems act like sculptures. They are arresting, stunning, and don't suggest absence or omission. They suggest careful composition. And in the stories they tell us, we learn something about the past, the future, and ourselves. It's what the best art should do, and it's not easy, but somehow Richie's work does this over and over again. It's something I'm sure you'll hear tonight. So I'll finish my introduction by including this quote from James Laugenbach, which I love so much. He says that Richie Hoffman inhabits elegance truly as a style, as a way of perceiving the world in which clarity and ornament are the same thing. The poems of Second Empire are written as they must be written because they are the poems of Richie Hoffman. I can't say it better than that. Please help me welcome Richie Hoffman.
Thank you so much, Adam. And thank you to everyone at UIS for having me. That was a beautiful introduction. I really appreciate it. And thank you for being here. That's great. I'm gonna put my water over back here, and I might have to like move out of the frame. And it's what I call a Marco Rubio. Just so we keep it political. Midwinter. Wearing Wellington boots, we followed the retriever along the perimeter of the property. Just that morning, a man and his son had brought in firewood from the fallen tree. Through Barberry, a small clearing in the woods, hollow like the inside of a cello. I walked around a tree stump like mustard seed. After sunset, we looked through a square window into the stark cabin where Jean writes. In a bubble in the antique glass, the sky swirled, reflected like a sequin, like summer even, though it was New Year's Day, and the world was dusky, and the dog, the house, the woods, the books, they weren't even ours. And a second winter poem. One of the weird things about finally reading from the book is that I don't know where any of the poems are inside of it. I actually don't know who wrote this. I'm like, who wrote this? What is this? Description. Where you were, everything was becoming ice. The paved courtyard, the windows looking out onto it. You traveled back and forth between buildings on a bus, passing trees and umbrellas inverted in the wind. You moved back and forth. I was elsewhere, in a small studio, painted white so many times the walls were thick with it. Once a poet told me, "Your eyes are whores." Once description was all I thought I needed to bridge things. And snow shawled the branches. And you took the keys from your pocket. And snow feathered the grass, which was mine to remember and forget. This poem is called Three Cranes, and sometimes you just have a poetic idea that you just have to stick with. And I had this idea while going over the bridge into a city near the beach, and I thought, I want to write a poem called Three Cranes with three sections, and I want the first one to be about Crane the bird, which is kind of like a stork which carries the babies. Though I once was corrected at a reading that said, actually, storks and cranes are quite different. Cranes are silent and storks make noise. Oh, that's a better poem than I ended up writing. And I wanted the second section to be about a construction crane and the third to be about the poet Hart Crane, whom Adam mentioned. But I knew I couldn't write it yet, so I held on to the idea for about 4 years, and then I finally did it. One, wading low through marsh and grass, quick and cautious, the crane too knows this. There is a freedom in submitting to another. Cranes mate for life. With necks outstretched, they take flight. A double arrow's stab of silver, released and then gone. I have searched for nourishment in you, like a long black beak in the earth. How was I to know what I would find there? Every night, we shrieked our presence to each other, desire or grief, lacquering us onto our lives like birds on a paneled screen. 2. All winter long, the men built another bridge, stacking slabs of metal and concrete near the barrier island where we lived. I was worried we had fallen from each other. Silent on the beach, we watched machines hoisted on and off the earth. Standing one-legged in the marsh, a crane, all steel and orange light, binding the horizon. What will become of us? I almost said. Gulls wove in and out of the cables, shrieking up and down within the stacks, in unison, I noticed, with our breath. It almost looked like a living thing. 3. Lying on my stomach, reading Crane's letters again, I felt a hand behind me. Orange light pressed the window. The hand that touched my shoulder was yours. I know now there is such a thing as indestructibility. Your confessor, I listened for your breath, the cables enclosing us and pulling us upward, but felt only the ceiling fan and traffic somewhere chafing against a wet street. Then your lips on my neck. I think the sea has thrown itself upon me and been answered before I closed the book and turned my body under yours. Today, when I first arrived in Springfield, which I love, Adam Clay gave me the option of seeing Lincoln's tomb, which I enthusiastically agreed to. And it was an amazing place. So many of these poems in this book take place around human remains. And so I now need to augment that collection with a Lincoln poem. This takes place in Atlanta at Emory University that has a wonderful Egyptian collection. And I always find it super creepy to be in the museum in the middle of the day when no one is there. And it's very dark, the lights are low, it's kind of cool. And there's a mummy and you can see its face and body and it's so close to you. I find that really unsettling. It's not like it's gonna reach up and grab you like in a horror movie, at least I hope not. But there's something still very kind of unsettling about that kind of stillness. And in the adjacent gallery, I was completely struck by a bowl of fruit. It was actually figs that were 30 centuries old, a kind of unfathomable amount of time. Egyptian bowl with figs. In the Egyptian gallery, dried fruit left in a bowl, as if time and beetles and a dead king had chewed around them, picked the fig flesh from his teeth, wiped clean his gaudy painted lips before his body was brushed with resin, a ball of linen lodged in his mouth, in his rectum, before a hairless priest pulled the brain out through the nose with a hook. So much history is painted in gold on a golden door, the rest carried off in the floodplain, or covered with earth, dropped in ceremonial jars with the dead king's brain, or into bowls of clay and a sycamore, like this one, which held me for an hour, wondering how long a handful of figs could nourish a man, myth-like. but I am young. My hair is the color of antique coins. No one I've loved has died. How can I know or say what hunger is? Sometimes to pass the time, I write rhyming poems, which is very unfashionable, but I really enjoy rhymes a lot. And I was reading near my hometown, which is in South Jersey, in November, and I realized that, you know, having a South Jersey accent makes rhyming really difficult sometimes, because instead of, you know, that great wet expanse called water, in South Jersey we say wooder, which doesn't really rhyme with anything good. So I learned something about myself. So this is a rhyming poem. Any rhyme fans? Wow. JK, I'll read the, no. You're gonna get it anyway. Mirror. You'd expect a certain view from such a mirror. Clearer than one that hangs in the entry and decays. I gaze past my reflection toward other things. Bat wings, burnt gold upon blue, which decorate the wall, and all those objects collected from travels, now seen between its great gold frame, diminished with age. A stage where still the supernatural corps de ballet displays its masquerade in the reflected light. At night, I thought I'd see the faces of the dead. Instead, the faces of the ghosted silver sea saw me. When I'm not rhyming, my other hobby is pretending to be other people, which is why I had such a good time playing with Adam's daughter Penny today, because we both live in a world of imaginative fantasy. And as was true today, and as is true most of the time, I pretend to be aristocratic women from other time periods. The following poem is one such result. At the Palais Garnier. We always arrived late, sometimes in masks. You wore a sword at your side. The heads that watched our little pageant were busts of the great composers, and not men lined up for the executions. The style was Second Empire, but the empire had already fallen by the time the facade was finished. The casts changed seasonally, like our lovers. I remember, through black lace fans, Hansel and Gretel eating a garish cake in the darkness. We covered our mouths when we laughed at the children trapped in the house of sweets. We ate cake at intermission in order to stay awake. I think that was the last poem I put in this collection, because after the title had been settled on Second Empire, I thought I should have a poem about the actual historical Second Empire in there, so people think I'm a little less weird than I already am. Keys to the City. Didn't rain choke the animal throats of the cathedral? Sputter against the roofs of the city? Didn't the flight of stairs rise up above the cobbled street? Didn't the key clamor in the lock flood the vestibule with clattering? Didn't we climb the second flight toward the miniature allegory painted on the ceiling and touch the flat-faced girls, winged part animal, who did not flinch and did not scamper. Egyptian cotton. Once, nothing separated us but the gossamer of sheets, white and gauzy in the summer, when a world of heat blew in, inflating the curtains into the room that was his and mine when no one else was there. Nothing between the body whose hot-bloodedness, whose frailty I had come to know the duration of my life, and the body he drank cool water with, the body he salted mile after mile along the coast, fucked me with which he told me what troubled him. The two of us in our bed of Egyptian cotton. The sea reflected us, our human emotions. Then the sea refused us, like the sea. I'll read some new poems now that aren't yet in a book. This book, or any book. So my real passion is teaching creative writing. I absolutely love being in a classroom, and I love being inspired by what my students produce. It always energizes my own writings. But I'm also borderline sadistic, and so I give them challenging assignments that are kind of impossible to do, and they don't actually have to follow the rules, but it gets them there. And one of my favorite forms to assign is a medieval Persian form called a ghazal or a huzzle. Some of you might have written one, but it's a wonderfully complex repeating form that basically repeats the same end word time and time again throughout the poem. But my favorite feature is that because it was transmitted orally, the way to ascribe authorship in these pieces was to have the poet's name in the text of the poem as a kind of living signature, so you'd know whose it was. So I thought after assigning this for so many classes, I should try one myself. So this poem is called Generations, and this goes out to any of you who are named after people and have that weird burden of being not the first one. Like you, aren't you the third? Yeah. I'm the fourth Richard in a row, and sadly, probably the last by biological means, though you never know. Generations. There is one photograph in which we all exist, each of us named Richard. Four firstborn sons. I am the youngest Richard. My grandfather heard it often in the yard, where he stirred soil, planting spring bulbs, his wife calling, Richard. His father's mother said it in rough Hungarian. It was the language we heard at home before the war, I read in a letter from Richard. For a time, we all lived in the same small town, absurd, I know. In Shanghai, my father is called Lucky Morals, where it's hard to say Richard. In the end, there's me, the baby in the picture, the end word. in a line that ends with Richard. My next book project has me researching family history, and it's taken me to a small town in Germany on the Rhine River called Speyer, where my ancestors worked as bakers making bread. And I was able to visit, and one of the bakeries that they operated is still a bakery today, though it's owned by a different family now. So I had this kind of cool experience of being able to buy bread in this building where they made bread for many centuries. But the first time I visited, I was a kid, and I absolutely hated it. Because my grandma told me if I misbehaved, I'd be put in the dungeon. And you already know my thing with being in the room with human remains and in those old cathedral crypts. It's called Imperial City. From the outset, I hated the city of my ancestors. I was fearful I'd be put in the dungeon below the cathedral. The best example of the Romanesque, a guide was saying in German, in English, in French, where are buried 8 German kings, 4 queens, 23 bishops, 4 Holy Roman emperors, all of whom used this bishopric on the river as the seat of the kingdom. On the old gate at one end, a clock told an ancient form of time. I sulked along behind my parents as the guide gave facts about the war with the Saracens, about the place where the Jews bathed, about the child like me, whose father, the peaceful, having already produced an heir by his first marriage, could marry for love. Bakery. I kneaded a mass of dough against a wooden table. I bundled the lettuces of South Germany. I wrapped flowers in yesterday's newspaper for a Jewish widow. I started a bakery at Johannesstrasse 13, the building built as a convent for nuns. The man that lived there before I did painted the insides of the dome, working in the studio of Herr Schraudolf to make paintings in the late Nazarene style for the king, who came himself to see them finished. First, I saw the cathedral over the wall. Later, in engravings, once full color, 4x6 on a postcard. I helped the painter wash his brushes. Colors diffused in a jar, goldenrod, pink. The bristles unstiffened with chemicals. I washed my hands. I spoke the same language as the emperor, though once I could not read it. It seems distant now, though I reach from time to time for a word that feels proper. I hear 2 women speaking the language I learned first. How do you say it? How is it pronounced? Fat babies had their heads touched with water every Sunday. That immense font separated the diocese from the people. People ate my bread. I decorated cakes for them when their children were baptized. I brushed pastries with egg before anyone else was awake. My name was recorded in the book. There are names going back to 1654. Jacob is there, August 2. Melchior is not. Either he was not 62 when he died, or he was not baptized like the others. Maybe he was born to parents in another village, as I was. In the 1950s, they removed the man's paintings to reveal the original architecture. I saw the insides of the dome bare again. I returned by way of Johannesstrasse. I wiped the wooden table clean. I set the dough to rise in the buttered bowl. So I really like opera and music, and I was researching the life of Richard Wagner, and I found out that he was born in a weird hotel that had this amazing name, the House of Red and White Lions. And I was at the same time reading a poem by Jory Graham, and she had a phrase in it, how one wants. And I thought, that's the poem. So I stole it and made it better. Do not tell Jory. The House of Red and White Lions. How one wants to be a kind of falling away. How one wants to have been a drop of blood. How one wants to mean, but to mean otherwise, like the intact skin of a beast, freshly flayed, cut by one man's knife or another's, also expertly, washed, sewed with dark gray lining, preserved in heat and chemicals, the stench gone of life, of what burned there, hanging from the windows of the fur district, storefronts owned by the prosperous Jews of Leipzig, early in the century, but late in the lives of certain men. How one wants merely to pass through. Banners streamering the sky. The wheels of a carriage passing by, pulled by the living horse with wet nostrils and a large meringue-colored eye. How one wants to be touched like that. The bears hanging in the windows, off the roofs, awnings of the Brühl, of the House of Red and White Lions, as off the muscular back of the Teutonic hunter god who finds his way by scent. How one wants to reach after him like a buyer in the marketplace of skins, just to touch his fur. So you already know I'm a little weird, but I used to be even weirder. And this poem is based on a true story. I really liked Mozart a lot as a little kid. I was kind of obsessed with him, and I wanted to be him, though I have no musical skill. So when you don't have talent, what's the next best thing? To dress the part. And so I remember wanting so bad one gift. And every time I opened a present, I thought, could this be the day when I will get the one thing that I've always wanted? Powdered wig. It is the only thing I want. I am 7, blonde-haired, fae in my interactions. I hold a bright green gift. I know I'm a boy, but I love the fancy things people had in the past. The present gleams in my hands. I touch the scotch tape, which holds the seams together and keeps what's inside hidden from me. please, let them have read my mind. And I'll finish with this poem called Birthday, and just want to thank you all again for coming out and being here, and to everyone who made this possible, especially Adam and WUIS, this really awesome space to live out my fantasy of like being a radio personality. It's just always what I've wanted, other than the wig. Birthday. I look for words in the dark, silently describing to myself the particular conditions of the weather on the morning I saw you most recently. The wind, its patterned disarray, my mind elsewhere, distracted, lyrical, while the pianist plays an encore. Mozart was born on this day, 257 years ago. All day, I have been ungenerous, resentful, impatient. In between movements, no applause, but the old ladies cough loudly, violently. We cannot last forever. I loved music before I loved books. I loved Mozart before I loved you.